Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Morelia Python Radio, brought to you by Morelia Python Forums, www.moreliapythons.com.
Uh-oh.
On the website. Oh, website. On the World Wide Web.
Oh, no. Man. Oh, no.
See, Owen, you had
five
the
minutes
you
in.
Threw me off.
Five minutes in and we've ruined it.
Oh, man. You just can't keep quiet until I'm done splurting that
it.
Out.
I'm sorry.
Oh, man.
I can't. I have to trip you up somehow. Come on.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, tonight we have the Chondro talk. I'm looking forward to it. And it seems like whenever we have Chondro guests on, they seem to have people call in and want to talk about Chondros. I think we have a caller on the line right now, actually.
No freaking
there.
Way.
Yeah. But if
we
you want to call
started.
In, you want to talk to our guest tonight is Marcel Mendez. The call-in number is 347-215-7359. And we'll be getting to some Chondro talk in a minute. And I think that's pretty much the only Python that you don't own at this point, Owen.
Goddamn,
I mean,
right.
What are you holding out for? I mean, come on.
Hey, and don't let's not talk about this, because I'll be fending people off at CarbonFest. And unfortunately, what some people are learning now is that if I say no, they're going to just call Chris, and then all of a sudden it happens. And then we're doomed.
Yeah.
So
I don't know if you saw the post, but when Chris posted up the fact that he bought the Tannen bars, I said, you know, now it's time to move on to the real deal and get some Chondros, you know.
Of course.
And
yeah, I'm looking at it right now, you son of a bitch.
Oh, hopefully he'll overrule
yeah.
you.
No. I make the rules here. But,
yeah.
Man, those tans, God, it's like they look so pretty and they're coming at your face. It's like, okay, never mind, put it back. So, I mean, it's thank God they don't get as big as Barnecks, or we'd be, like, leading in with trash can lids and full body armor. I mean, they are pitiful.
Bastards. Yeah, spicy as little babies. And what are they? You got juveniles? Is that where you're at now?
Yeah, I think they're about a year old. But, man, the names that they came with are Sunshine and Striker. And Sunshine is like a holy terror. I don't know why we even put up with her, but okay. So but it's definitely cool to have another species of scrub. And, I mean, who doesn't love scrub pythons?
Yeah.
Bite your tongue. Bite it now. Stop it.
I can't believe that, you know, for somebody that has carpet pythons, now scrub pythons, is in love with rough scale pythons.
Yes.
Which is basically the sister's doesn't own a condo.
I know.
You know what it is?
I
think that you're just afraid that once you get one condo, you're going to sell off your collection and just...
That's what Buddy says is going to happen, okay?
That is what you're afraid of. That's exactly what
I'm terrified. Absolutely terrified. I'll have chondros. People will be like, oh, and you want these rough scales for free? I'm like, no, more chondros.
Chondros.
Yeah, no, that ain't going to happen. But, yeah, it's definitely very cool, and hopefully we're done for now. Make it stop, please.
Yeah.
But, you know, of course, you're not helping from dropping off pictures of T-positive albino white lips that I'm like, if I get a boat and go to Denmark, can I get them and bring them back? So, and fantastic looking. And then Ari's talking about the red-faced white lips last week, and I'm like, God damn it. So my checkbook is begging you people to stop.
Yeah. But that's what makes it fun.
I know it's what makes it fun. It's terrible.
Yeah.
But, so what's going on over at your end? Anything horribly exciting? Did you, like, hatch out a one-eyed purple flying carpet python from your zebra pet for craziness? Or
No,
we're not even there yet. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'll save that for egg season.
Yeah. I spent the day putting together a light box.
Aren't you handy?
Yeah, and it's relatively simple. I watched a YouTube video on it, and I got my, like I said, my dad let me borrow his camera, and he has one of those. I went from a Snoopy camera to a paparazzi camera. I'm a real
Your dad's going to be like, can I have the camera back? You're like, what camera? I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, yeah, I was in the market for getting a new camera, and I wanted to mess around with it, so he let me borrow his camera, and he wasn't really using it, and just to get a feel for, like, what I was looking for and what I was needed in a camera. So it's definitely cool to take a picture, and it actually represents your snake.
what you're looking at, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So that's cool.
Awesome.
Let's see. As far as in the news, I was talking to Chris Behoff, and I asked him if we could talk about the poll of the week over there on Morelia Python forums, and figured it would be a way to get more people over there to check out the forum. But basically what Chris does is he does a question of the week or a poll of the week, basically. And I figure that we'll touch on what last week's was, and then we'll let you know what this week's is, and you can go over there and cast your vote on what you think. But if you have any suggestions for that, you can always send Chris a message over on Facebook. He is CB Reptiles. Basically, anything yellow, Chris has. So.
Yeah, look for a yellow and black snake. Chances are it's probably him.
Yeah, that's him. So I think the poll of the week last week was, do you keep adult carpets in racks?
I do. I do as well. I have several that stay in the bins, especially the smaller species. My IJs normally are in bins, as well as some of my jungles, but nothing. I don't keep my 8-foot coastals in a bin. That'd be pretty goddamn big bin. But
yeah. I think your coastals especially would not fit in any kind of bin. So
this is true.
Yeah, the results from that poll, they basically you had about 24% that said that they did keep them in racks and they were happy with the results. But I think the thing with Morelia is basically they don't, and they never would do it, because I think the consensus was that they want to see them.
Yeah,
you know?
You want to see it, and you're not going to be able to see it if it's in tub. So yeah, makes sense.
That's the one thing I don't like about the keeping the ones in tubs. But basically, the way I'm going to approach is the males are going to be in tubs, and the females will be in cages. So
I see. Torture the boys. Got it. So
yeah,
we don't need to see them anyway. I agree. There's certain things you can do with that, and all these polls now are all going to get each other's opinions.
Yeah.
All going to know what we all think. So
exactly. Good. Well, that's stirs up a good
debate.
I think the I forget what the poll was this week. Do you remember?
No.
I'm trying to look it up real quick. So what's going on over at your spot?
My spot? No, a whole lot of cuddling with, jungles and IJs and various other critters. But in other news, I was really kind of disappointed to hear that Sean Halfleck from Python Hunters and was a guest on our show had a baby albino alligator stolen from him. During a fundraiser for crocodiles. Right. Yeah. Somebody just walked in and plucked the little guy out and walked out with it. And there was a couple scary days. I think it was like 2 days where Sean was there trying to investigate where the hell this little guy went. And thankfully it was recovered. But, that's, I can imagine that being very scary, especially because those captive baby albino gators, I think, were the first ones ever hatched in captivity. And, captive bred and born, I mean, and it's definitely be a very big loss if it was never recovered, because I guarantee you whoever took it couldn't care for it the way that it needed to be cared for. It'd be just a loss, and it's awfully scary to think about that, is that if you let people in to check out your animals or your facility, what are they really planning on? There are numerous accounts of people coming in to check out a ball python that was for sale or this for sale, and then the person gets broken into a few days later and those animals are gone. So just remind everybody to keep your close eye on your stuff, I guess. You don't want anything getting plucked from you. I think it was a prehistoric pet who got het albino carpets taken from them a little bit ago. They just got plucked from their store. So...
Well, speaking of that, then this would be a good segue into the poll. Do you tell your neighbors about your reptiles?
Ah, I do not. For several reasons. It's, and that's also why I don't take pictures outside. People are like, why don't you just take a picture of your carpet python in a tree out front? I'm like, because I don't want to freak my neighbors out. So I don't tell them about it. Most of them know about it, and if they are interested in seeing it, I will definitely take them down to see the room, but I don't walk and tell everybody on the block that I got the snakes. Of course, I have that tire cover that doesn't help the situation. Shit. All right. let me rethink this. It's one of those things that they don't need to know, especially because there was, I think there's technically an ordinance of telling me how many I'm allowed to have, but I don't pay attention to it. So, yeah, they don't need to know. Do you tell your neighbors?
No. I don't really talk to my neighbors like that, so I don't really have neighbors that are really nice.
Right.
It's not like when I grew up, when I grew up, you knew all your neighbors. It's kind of, I'm kind of isolated a bit, believe it or not. So, anyway, so that's the poll. Go over there and vote on it. Put your thoughts in there and see what everybody says. I want to throw out a quick shout out to Herp Nation. Their article by Mark Spataro, who was a guest way back in the day, talking Bowen's pythons. But that article is out in the the December Herp Nation. From what I hear, this Herp Nation is a pretty solid magazine, and after hearing about the carpet article that was in the Reptiles magazine, I think Herp Nation is probably the way I'm going to go.
Me, yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah, that'd be nice.
yeah, go over there, check it out. And I think Mark, basically, he's talking about his breeding from this year of Bolens pythons. I'm not really sure. I want to say two babies hatched out. I'm not 100%, but I think he was kind of keeping that under wraps until the article came out. So I think once the article comes out, you'll see a lot more, especially over on MorelliaPythons.com about, you know, pictures and how everything is going and
excellent,
et cetera. So, so check that out. And the only other thing I wanted to mention is, you know, we have chondros, and we're talking chondros, and, you know, I was cruising the Facebook chondro page. I think it's called the Chondro Room. And I was looking at Greg Stevens. He has a black chondro. They were calling it the
name.
But, I mean, holy black, man. It's good Lord. You know, I asked him about it. And he said basically it comes from a 50% Trooper Walsh bloodline with a splash of Golden Sky and a Rue blood. But the thing is, it's black as night. I mean, it's awesome.
The hell does that mean? I think you just described, like, some sort of witch's brew or something with the craziness that you just spat out there.
Trooper Walsh was the guy that, and I'm sure Marcy Hell can talk better than this, but Trooper Walsh was the guy that first dealt with chondros in the States. So mm-hmm. he was one of the guys that was responsible for getting them going in the U.S. And I'm not sure what the Golden Sky. I know I read that in the Complete Chondro and Aru. That's just a locality. So
okay.
But Greg Stevens, he has some wild stuff going on. But yeah, go over there, check it out on the Chondro Room. Cool stuff.
Awesome.
But if you don't have anything else, we'll get the show going, and we'll bring Marcy on.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I click on the right guy.
I hope so.
Is that you, Marcy?
Yes. How's
that? Yes.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We did a good job. All right, well, I'm ready to be educated, Marcia. I want you to got to convince me to get chondros. It's up to you now because we've had other people on, and here I am, chondroless. So, yeah, dazzle me. Anyway, so why don't you start with what got you interested into reptiles in the first place?
Let's see. Well, like most people who are listening, I started off at a pretty young age. I think I was maybe 6 or 7 years old. I started off with fish and aquariums, which I'm still really into. I really don't have one right now just because I don't have time anymore. But I was in the pet store with my dad buying fish, and this was probably in the late 70s. And they had some little baby garter snakes for sale. And saw one, and, you know, luckily my parents were, you know, very understanding and pretty much would let me keep anything that I wanted as long as it wasn't, you know, venomous or dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And and so that's what started it. Started off with the western red-sided garter snake, and then went to corn snakes, and then, you know, kings, and had a bull snake. Then I got my first boa constrictor, and, you know, back in the day, it was, you know, baby berms were a thing to have. So it just kind of escalated from there.
Okay. That's usually how everyone goes, get one, and then you kind of tear off onto your own. So
yeah,
what brought
you?
Yeah,
pretty much had them ever since I was, you know, since I was, like I said, 5 or 6 years old. Pretty much my whole life, with the exception of the time that I was in college. I didn't have any
right.
time. But as soon as I finished school, I started the collection up that I have now. And that was
awesome.
In 98. So this what I'm working with now is, you know, about 15 years in the making now.
Nice. So what led you to chondro?
Well, I'd always seen pictures of them in books, chondros and emeralds, and when I was a kid, I lived in Tampa, Florida, and luckily I had a connection to a family member of this guy who was a big importer at the time. I mean, I think he's still got a business open. It's called the Southeast Reptile Exchange. And
okay.
You heard of him?
Yeah, I think I have.
Okay.
It sounds really, really familiar. Like possibly I bought some animals from there, but I don't know. So. Because I have very terrible memory when it comes to that crap.
I'm pretty sure they're still around. I see ads from them on Kingsnake every now and then. And I want to say that somebody told me they, like, you know, breed alligators now, maybe. So
then I didn't get it.
I mean, I think they have other stuff, too. But anyway,
okay.
So this guy was a pretty big, you know, importer-exporter kind of guy. And his name is Joe Fossey. And my dad used to take me over to his house and his facility. And, you know, you can imagine I'm like an 8-year-old kid and walking around, and he used to have just all kinds of crazy stuff, huge monitors and all kind of venomous stuff and, you know, anything you could think of.
Jeez.
In his personal collection at his house, he had two green tree pythons, a pair of them, and they were Marukis. I still remember the first time I see them like it was yesterday. Two, you know, green snakes with the perfect white pinstripe coiled up, and really, from that point on, I was hooked. I actually didn't own any chondros until after college. I started the collection that I have now, just because back when I was a kid, they were just ridiculously expensive. If you could even get them. I did have some emeralds at the time, which they just seemed to be easier to get, and you know, they weren't as expensive as the chondros were back then. So that's really what got me into it. And then after I graduated college, started, you know, again, just reading and getting online and, you know, all the different color variations and how there's just so much variability in them from one animal to the next that you would think that maybe they're completely different species. You know, if you look at a green one versus a black one or a high yellow or a calico or a blue, there's just, you know, so many possibilities
right.
As far as color goes. I think that's what really attracted me to them more than anything else.
They do kind of come in all the different types that you want. Variations are ridiculous in these guys. It's kind of crazy when you think about it. So what size is the collection that you're working with right now? I mean, you got 3 rooms full of these guys, or do you have a manageable collection?
No, it's in the basement of my house. It's probably a 25 by 20 room, give or take. The overall collection, chondros are, I have probably about 75 to 80 of what I would call breeder animals, adults. They're not all chondros. About a third of them are chondros.
Okay.
And then the rest of the collection is made up of, I have a small group of emeralds, I have some basins and some basin northern crosses, and I have a small group of Borneo shorttails, and the rest of the collection is everybody's favorite ball pythons. So.
So you have these really sleek, sexy looking perching things, then you got these short, fat ones that are on the ground. You got the short tails and the ball pythons. You got both ends of the spectrum. That's awesome.
So the collection's about 85, like I said, 85 animals, and about a third is chondros. And then, you know, baby-wise, it just depends. At the peak of baby hatching season, depends on what kind of year I have. You know, it seems to either be feast or famine. There's been years where I've hatched, you know, 5 chondros, and there's been years when I've hatched 50, and there's really no rhyme or reason. I can't put my finger on why one year is better than others. It's just the way it happens sometimes. So, you know, the overall collection could be anywhere from 100 to 150, 200. And then as the year goes on, I sell off the offspring, stuff like that. So that's about the size of it.
awesome.
It's a decent sized collection. I, you know, to me, it's not as big as some people that I'm friends with and that I've seen, but to the average person with, you know, a couple of snakes, it probably seems pretty big.
Yeah,
but who are those people? So, what are some of the highlights of your collection? Like, what are your standout favorite ones?
I have got a couple of animals that I've produced myself that are some of my favorites as far as just, you know, as far as being a personal favorite. They're not super crazy to look at, a lot of them. Some of them are. And I've got a lot of stuff. When I started the collection, I was kind of on the long-term plan. And when I started it with basically 10 neonate chondros that I bought over the course of about a year, raised them all up. I bought, made it a point to buy half locality animals and half of like the best designer stuff that I could afford at the time, with the idea that I would start crossing the two. And that was kind of the foundation of, you know, my line going forward. And I've got animals now that are from the result of my first breeding, second breeding, that now are, you know, my breeders. So those I really like. And then I've got stuff from pretty much all the designer bloodlines you've heard of, Calico, Dream. I've got pretty good bit of Nikolai, high yellow stuff. I have a male Versace that is Versace is just what I've named him, but he has produced a lot of really cool offspring for me. He is from Trooper Wall, so I've got some of his stuff. I've got some of Greg Maxwell's stuff before he got out of the, you know, snake business. So I've kind of got a pretty broad variety of things. I don't have a lot of locality stuff anymore. I don't think I have any full-blooded localities in the collection. I think everything I've got is at least a cross of some type. So other than localities, I've got a little bit of everything.
Awesome. That's going to be very cool.
So you just hit on some of the designer lines like the Calico and Trooper Walsh and all those different. Can you give us some history on like some of those lines, like Calico? Where did that originate from?
Well, pretty much all of the designer lines that people work with today, the majority of them can be traced back to Trooper Walsh. And there's a few others, Al Zulik, his blue, he had a couple of blue animals that are kind of the foundation of the blue animals that people work with today. Trooper was responsible for the first captive breeding of chondros in the U.S., and that was maybe he might have been the second. I think the Sedgwick County Zoo, which I believe is in Kansas, was actually the first by like a couple of months, but certainly he was the first private entity to do it. I think that was in sometime in the mid to late 70s. And most of the designer lines, you know, from today emanate from his earlier breedings. And I think at the time, you know, this was way before we even knew about localities and, you know, back then you were just lucky to have a pair of green tree pythons, whatever they look like. So because of that, I think, is why, you know, a lot of people seem to be turned off by the fact that there's not a lot of people breeding locality chondros, like, you know, like Carbis and other types of Morelia, where the locality is very important. And I think it, a lot of that has to do with the fact that just the history of it and how when it started, nobody knew what localities were. And then when people started having success breeding them, there was already these designer morphs that just because that's what people had been producing, you know?
Right. Does the same debate ensue in the chondro world that, say, it does in the carpet world, where if you say you have a locality, then you can't really prove that it's a locality? And
right, yeah. It does. I mean, it used to happen a lot way back in the early days of Kingsnake, back when people were just starting to kind of get on internet forums and stuff. That was a pretty common debate. You don't see it as much anymore. And, you know, I don't know why that is, other than it's just kind of a played out thing to talk about, I guess. But, yeah, there's that same debate. Not so much in the chondro forums, just because for whatever reason, most of the people who are on the chondro forums seem to be into designer-type lines as opposed to the localities. But for whatever reason that is, at least the people that are on the popular internet chondro forums, there are still quite a few people that have locality stuff and work with locality stuff, and there's a lot of people that have both. That, you know, have designers and locality stuff, you know, which is great. I like localities. I think some of them are really beautiful. A nice Aru is pretty close to the pinnacle of what a green street python could look like, in my opinion. The problem with them is that to breed them, it just takes so much work to get the babies going, and you're trying to compete with importers who are selling them for, you know, $200 a piece, and it just makes it, to me, and for my personal, what I do, it's just, to me, it's just not worth it to do it. So that's one of the reasons why I don't really work with localities.
Okay. Now, you were hitting on, you told us about Versace, which is a screaming chondro, by the way. But can you tell us Prime Junior and the season that you just had with him?
Yeah, sure. Optimus, it's actually Optimus Black Junior. His name's changed a couple of times. that's an animal that he's got Calico and Dream on one side. And on the other side is Signal Herc or Rico Walters' P&G line. And he is essentially I think he's an 09 animal, so he's coming up on 4 years old now. And he is probably about 75 to 80% just jet glossy black. A lot of times you see black on chondros, and a lot of animals will go through a phase where, when they're changing from their neonate colors to adult, a lot of red babies from different lines, the blue line is one, kind of go through this black phase where they change from dark maroon or red, and they kind of start getting a few black specks, and then the next thing you know, they're completely black. And then over the course of a year or 2 years, the black kind of starts to fade out, and then you end up with a snake. Most of them do keep some degree of black, but nothing white when they're at the peak. That's like my male Versace. You know, he at one point was, 70% black, and now he's probably like 13 years old or something, and he's still got some flex, but when you see him from across the room, he basically looks like a green snake.
Wow.
So Optimus Black is unusual in the fact that he has maintained the black, and just from looking at him and what he looks like, I think he's going to keep it. I think he's done changing. I've had him, he's owned by Barry Manson and Andrew Kelly, and I've actually just got him here on loan. And he's been here for about, I guess, coming up on 2 years now. And he looks pretty much exactly the same as the day he got here. And the thing is just a crazy monster breeder. He'll breed anything. Breed a stick if you put it in his cage. which is great. You know, you put him in with a female, and within 10 or 15 minutes of the lights going out, he's all over. So that's you know, that's obviously a valuable animal to have. And it just so happened that, you know, they sent him here in, I think it was probably like March of 2010. And last year I had just four or five really nice females that were just primed and ready to go, and just put him in with each one, and by some stroke of luck, three of them ended up grad, and all the babies that came out were just ridiculous. I mean, they were they were the nicest babies I've personally ever produced. And now they are just starting to change colors. So here for the next, you know, probably for the next year or so, it's going to be real fun to watch them and kind of see what they do.
That's very cool.
Cool. Now, so when you said the Dreamline, can you hit a little bit on that?
Yeah, Dream was an animal that was owned by a guy named Jeff Hudson. He was another guy that was, when I was getting into chondros back in the late 90s, he was kind of one of the, you know, premier kind of top-level breeders of green trees, if you want to call it that. And he had a really nice collection, green trees, Amazon basins, along with a bunch of other stuff. And Dream, I'm really not sure the history of the animal, but it was a blue, it's a female, and she was a blue animal with big yellow diamonds down her back, and she just produced really amazing-looking stuff. So over the years, the Dream line has been crossed with lemon trees and calicos and, you know, just about everything else you can think of, and not always, but a lot of the babies end up very, very nice. I don't think there's a specific, I don't think there's like a specific phenotype that they tend to follow. It's kind of like calicos, where they could be all over the board. And if you see a calico, you know, hey, yeah, that's a calico, but it could be a black calico, could be a yellow calico. They vary a lot.
Yeah,
Dreamline is kind of the same way in that regard.
So chondro genetics are kind of not predictable like your standard say ball python genetics where you got codon recessive.
Unfortunately it's not quite as simple. It's completely different. I like to think of it as kind of like the way we have all these animals in all these lines that people are working with today is from selective breeding. So you take two animals that, just as an example, maybe have a couple of yellow specks and you breed them together. Well, their offspring, a certain percentage of them, maybe 10 to 20% of the clutch, are going to have more yellow than the parents. And then you take those babies and breed them together, and then a certain percentage of those babies are going to have more yellow than the parents. And luckily, because of the work that Trooper did back in the 70s, we've got bloodlines now that have, you know, 30 years of selective breeding behind them. And that's kind of what you're paying for when you see these crazy prices for designer animals. It's not like a simple recessive where you breed these two together and you're going to get 25% calico. Unfortunately, you know, it doesn't work that way. You may breed two calicos together and you might not get any calicos. You might get 75% of the clutch could be calico. A lot of this depends on the compatibility of two specific animals. And even that could vary from clutch to clutch. You might get one clutch from them that's off the charts, and you may get another clutch that's maybe as good or maybe it's not as good. So there's really just not a whole lot of... The bloodlines are getting more refined as we go on, and it's getting a little bit more predictable. But for the most part, still, it's definitely not something like a simple recessive or dominant trait.
Right, right. Well, that's what makes it so much fun, right? I mean, it's like a kind of
fun. Fun. I'd go crazy.
Well, I mean, you're kind of taking a gamble. And even if you don't, let me ask this question. Even if, let's say you bought an animal from the Dreamline, and even if you don't get the animal to turn out like that, you still have those genetics in that animal that it's possible that at some point it can produce something down the line similar to
that's
that line, correct? Right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. And a lot of it will depend on what animal you breed it with. And there's some animals that, for example, Optimus Black Jr. has a brother. His name is Dr. Pepper, and he is not anywhere near as extreme looking as OB Jr. is. He's a nice looking animal. He's got, you know, a nice you know, maybe 10-15% black scales kind of scattered over him. But he has produced some animals that are just as black as OB Jr. So the genetics, even though it may not express itself in that particular animal, you still, you know, it's still a good thing to have that. You know, obviously you always want the animal that has the phenotype too, but
sure.
The genetics are good to have.
Okay.
The animal doesn't show the traits that you're looking for itself. You certainly have a higher chance of producing something like you want if you use an animal from that bloodline.
Okay. Now, for someone like myself, who I keep other Morelia, and I do have a couple of chondros, but if I wanted to put together a decent collection of chondros, like, what would be your recommendation to get a good solid breeding group together? You know, I heard you say earlier that you sort of had your females were all locality types, and your males were all you know, designer lines. Is that a good? I guess that's a good.
Well, it didn't necessarily work out like that. I had about half and half. You can't sex them when they're babies, so I bought all babies and I had started off with some locality males and some designer males and vice versa, you know, same thing on the females. So my advice to somebody would be the absolute best way to do it is to start with neonates and raise them up. Buy a group of them, you know, the nicest bloodlines that you can afford or what, you know, what appeals to you as far as the phenotype that you like or the color that you want. And try to buy things that, you know, maybe you want to cross a calico and a dream or, you know, a calico and a Vioc or whatever. And just buy neonates. And it takes patience and you got to raise them up and it takes you a couple years. And but that is the least expensive way. And in my opinion, you'll be the most successful doing it that way. Adult chondros, when you ship them and you move them around, they tend to not do very well, in my experience.
Okay.
So the best thing is to buy babies and just take your time and raise them up. That is, you know, it's a long-term kind of deal, and if you don't have patience, you're not going to like, you know, you're not going to like it. But I think that is, you know, that'd be the best advice I think I could give to somebody who was looking to kind of start from scratch and get into it.
Okay. Cool.
Oh, should I have written that down for starting from scratch? Oh,
yeah.
Never mind.
Yeah.
Anyway, why don't you tell us what's your approach for keeping them? What do you put them in as far as caging wise and things like that?
I've gone through over the years a ton of different types of caging. I've tried pretty much every kind of cage you can imagine that's out there as far as like pre-manufactured. I never tried building any. I've always just been too lazy or not had time or whatever. But I've tried, you know, I've tried the Freedom Breeder displays, I've tried Visions, I've tried Boafile, I've got some PVC cages, just kind of a mishmash of stuff. And what I personally like the best as far as function and what I've sort of gone to, I think I have more of these than anything else. I've probably got about 20 or so Vision Arboreal Cube, which is basically just a they're about 30 inches across by 24 by 24. And they're not super attractive as far as to look at them. But function-wise, I think they're pretty hard to beat. You know, they're one piece, all plastic. You don't have to worry about the moisture getting to them. They're pretty easy to retrofit with heat panels and perches and whatever else you want to do to them. And I've got some that are 13 years old that you can't tell them apart from the ones that I got a month ago.
Okay.
So that's kind of what I like the best, and that's what I'll buy from here on out if I expand is Visions. I keep them pretty minimalist set up. I've tried all kinds of pretty much everything you can think of for substrate. I've tried Cypress, butcher paper, and I just use newspaper now.
It's
fairly inexpensive. And I like the idea, instead of spot cleaning like they used to do with Cypress, I like the idea of being able to take everything out of the cage and spray it down and clean it every time the snake dirties it.
Okay.
And I just use plastic perches, either plastic rod or some of my cages have PVC. I've got a few that have had, like, crepe myrtle branches that I started using when I first started setting cages up. I used to use Cypress with natural perches, and they work fine. I just like the plastic rod because it's easy to clean, and versus PVC, where you can clean the outside, but it's kind of a pain in the ass to clean the inside of the tube once you seal the ends off. So the plastic's nice just because it's solid. You don't have to worry about cleaning the inside. All the adult cages have a radiant heat panel in them off to one side, and I keep the hot spot at the perch around 90 degrees, high 80s. And then on the cool side, it's room temperature, which fluctuates depending on if I'm cycling or not, and what the temperature's doing outside. But I have the room on a separate thermostat, and basically for a daytime high, the ambient temperature gets about 82 degrees. And depending on if I'm not cycling, I drop it into the high 70s at night. And if I am cycling during the 6 months of the winter, I drop it into the low 70s at night. The heat panels all shut off at night all year round. So at night,
okay,
you get a drop down to either high 70s or low 70s, and then during the day, they've got, 88, 89 under the panel and 82 on the cool side.
Okay, gotcha.
And I keep the chondros that way. I keep the emeralds that way. Back when I used to have carpets, I kept them the same way. So for any type of arboreal snake, that's pretty much what I found works for me.
Okay. So what's your feed regimen like?
I pretty much feed pretty sparingly, especially adults. Babies, I will feed babies pretty often, actually, at least once a week, sometimes every 4 to 5 days, until they're about a year old. Once they start eating hopper mice or wean mice, I'll start kind of slowing them down. But when they're babies, I like to feed them at least once a week. And then adults and basically anything over a year old, I feed every other week, and only mice. My biggest female, I'll give two, maybe three adult mice every 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay. So, why don't you, is there any way you can debunk some of the myths that are surrounding chondros? Because I remember when I first got into pythons in general, the Chondras were, especially with your emeralds too, was they need heavy misting because that's the only way they drink their water is the droplets off their scales, and they can be nasty, nasty, nasty animals, things like that. Can you kind of debunk some of those myths for us?
Most of the myths are the kind of stereotypes that you hear about them being nasty and not doing well and being difficult. All that is pretty much based on people's experience with wild-caught animals. And, you know, for the most part, wild-caught animals do hold true to a lot of those stereotypes. However, captive bred animals are completely different. You don't have the they're not as mean, and generally, you'll get one or two
right.
that likes to bite or just doesn't want to be messed with. But for the most part, out of the, 30 or so adults that I have, there may be three or four that I can't just reach in and grab them off the perch. So as far as the temperament goes, it does vary from snake to snake, and you do occasionally get a mean one, but for the most part, they're not as aggressive as their reputation would lead you to believe.
Okay.
I mean, they're not ball pythons, obviously, but they're not the big mean biters that they have the reputation of being. And then as far as the other stuff, again, captive bred, you don't typically have problems with them health wise that you do with wild-caught stuff. I don't miss a lot. I do spray the cages down maybe once or twice a week, and if an animal's in shed, I'll keep the cage pretty damp. But for the most part, they're dry. On newspaper, they have a water bowl, and I have seen just about every snake in the room drink from the water bowl. So, the idea or the myth that they don't drink from water bowls is not true. They will drink off their coils if you spray them, but they will also drink from a water bowl. So the way I keep them is basically, like I said, dry, and maybe like once or twice a year, depending on, what time of the year it is outside and what the temperature is outside and how hard the heater is working in the room. I'll spray the newspaper. I rarely spray the animals directly. I'll just basically get like a coiling water hose that I'll just come in and just soak the newspaper once or twice a week, and then it'll get completely dry, and then three or four days later, I'll soak it again.
Okay.
Good ventilation, I think, is key. You definitely don't want to keep them damp constantly. And you don't want to keep them too cool. That, in my experience, is a recipe for disaster as far as getting respiratory infections. I think you can keep them cooler, but don't keep them wet. Keep them wet and cool is bad. If you keep them hot, they can take a little bit more moisture and humidity. But for whatever reason, I've had very few respiratory infections over the years, and that is one of the things that you read about as being, kind of a plague of chondras. They get respiratory infections, and I've not experienced that. I think a lot of that has to do with people thinking they have to keep them real wet, and then you have a wet cage, and maybe you don't. You have a cool night or something like that, or you're not keeping them warm enough or giving them the opportunity to warm up. And if you keep them real wet, then you're going to have problems. So
right.
A lot of it is humid. They're not as forgiving of humidity, of husbandry air as a lot of other species are. But once you meet their their minimum needs or whatever, you don't really have problems with them.
Right. Okay. So they're a little bit more difficult, perhaps not a beginner snake.
Yeah, probably not a beginner snake. I mean, I say that if it's somebody who is like, you know, really into it, and you read a lot, and you watch the snake, and you kind of observe the snake, and you can look at the snake. You know, once you get used to what one looks like, you can just walk into the room and tell by their posture or how they're coiled or there's just little things that I can walk into the room and look at and be like, yeah, that doesn't look right. And then you kind of hone in on that and just keep your eye on that particular animal. So as far as if you're a good beginner snake, if you're a person that's observant and that likes to read, and there's a lot of information out there and lots of forums and obviously you can go for help, but if you are really into it and, you know, you make it a priority to meet this snake's needs, then it's fine to get a snake. But most people who are just getting into it aren't like that. A lot of contrary people are kind of obsessive about a lot of things, the bloodlines and lineages and, egg incubation. People freak out over tenths of a degree on their incubator, and that's just for whatever reason, that is just the kind of person that Hondo seems to draw. So for whatever reason, I don't know why that is, but it seems to be a pretty constant thing with people who are really into it. A lot of Hondo nerds out there.
You guys are proud of yourselves, aren't you?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I saw your post on the prolapse you recently had on MVP. Is there any way you can walk us through what happened, what you think caused it, and kind of how you fixed it?
Prolapses are one of, I would say prolapses and respiratory infections are probably the two number one ailments that you deal with when you have green tree pythons for long enough.
Mm-hmm.
Prolapses are something that I personally have not had a lot of experience with in older animals. For whatever reason, in my experience, it's usually been babies that prolapse on me. So this was an unusual case, and then this was an adult animal that was, I hatched it. It's been in my, it's a 2005 animal, so that makes it, seven, 8 years old, something like that. Never had a problem before. It's a proven breeder, female.
Mm-hmm.
Just all around been a great snake, never any issues. And I just so happened to be in the room, and it was taking a dump. And it's not something you get to, not something you see every day. So I was sitting there, I was watching it, and the first couple, the first bit of it came out, and then she was kind of sitting there swinging her tail back and forth, and I could tell she was having trouble packing the last of it. And finally, I'm sitting there looking at it, and it started coming out, and I was like, wait a minute. That looks like not poop, but it looks like she's pushing, her, her guts out.
Yeah.
And I think what basically had happened was the feces was real hard for whatever reason, and she was pushing so hard that it kind of twisted it around, and instead of coming out the hole where it's supposed to come out, she actually pushed the whole tissue out. I think of it as like a sock. With a tennis ball in it, to get the tennis ball out, it's got to come out the end. Well, the end was kind of turning the wrong direction, and she kept pushing, so the tennis ball came outside the body along with the rest of that, with the sock that's around it. So
yeah.
I saw it, and I was like, holy shit, this is bad, it's huge, I didn't really know what to do, so I don't... The worst thing you can do, in my opinion, in general, is to freak out and try to just do something. So what I did was I just pulled it out of the cage, put her in, you can't let it get dry. That's one of the main things. Put her in a tub with some shallow water in it and left her alone for a couple hours. And, you know, I was hoping that maybe she would pass it or fix it or, you know, go back in or whatever. Well, came back down a couple hours later and still this huge thing sticking out. So I was, before I, you know, really closely looked at it and saw what was going on, I was pretty much had written her off. I've never seen one recover from a prolapse that bad. So anyway, I'm like, let me try something. So I pulled her out, and this was kind of, it was late at night at this point. It was 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning, and wife was asleep. I wasn't going to go wake her up and ask her to help me come deal with the snake. So I've got her, and I'm sitting here by myself. And so basically I kind of opened up the tub a little bit, just enough to get her tail out, and sort of held the rest of her body, kept the rest of her body in the tub where I had both hands free to kind of hold the tail. And once I saw what was going on, it just looked like the feces had kind of gotten turned sort of 90 degrees, and it was real stiff, so it wasn't like smushing or getting or anything. And so all it took was me, I gently kind of grabbed the tissue and rotated it to where the end of the sock was pointing in the same direction as the poop, and it just popped right out. And I did that. I set her back in the tub, and within 5 minutes, or probably less than that, it had completely stuck back in, and she's been fine ever since. So,
well, fantastic.
It was unusual in the fact that I was able to see it happening, which, you know, most of the time you don't see your snakes pooping.
no, it just kind of happens.
Yeah, you just come in the next morning and it's there. So it was unusual in the fact that I witnessed it happening, and I was able to immediately put her in a soaking tub. I think a lot of the reasons why maybe other animals don't recover as quickly is because, if the tissue is exposed and it gets dried out, it seems like it's harder to fix it. So I was, again, lucky in that regard. She's been fine ever since. So I'll probably just keep it. You know, keep a close eye on her for the next few months, and feed her maybe a little less than the rest, and a little sparingly, and maybe soak her in between feedings. And I think dehydration or not being fully hydrated may have played a little bit of a role in it, because typically she shouldn't be as hard as this was, and.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that really has changed with my husbandry over the last couple of months is earlier this year I started breeding my own rodents, finally gave in after I've never done it. And just with having baby ball pythons, you pretty much have to have live food. So I started doing it this year, and I had always fed the green trees frozen thawed mice, which I would just throw in a big tub and soak them in hot water and just feed them right out of the water, soaking wet.
Mm-hmm.
Since I breed my own rodents now, I've been feeding a lot more fresh killed, which basically, just gas the rodents and just feed them off tongs. The same way, just the rodents aren't sopping wet. And maybe that's really the only thing I could come up with as far as something that I've changed or that's different. You think about how much water is on a wet mouse or rat, it's probably a lot. You rang it out.
True.
Compared to, it's probably what a snake would drink in a sitting or two. So I think I'm going to switch everything, go back to my old ways, and actually just thaw out the mice and feed them frozen thawed again.
Well, hopefully that works out and we won't have any more problems. I mean, I would imagine it's a pretty scary thing. What are your thoughts about that? I know people say that chondros can be prone to prolapses. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I really don't know. I think a lot of it could be related to maybe it's related to hydration, but I really don't know why, because you don't really see it in a lot of other, even other Morelia. You don't really see it in really any other species that I can think of. It's not real common. Whereas for whatever reason with chondros, it just seemed to be one of those things. I don't really know why.
Now I know that somebody, I saw a similar post, something about hard fecal material. Do you think that's something else that kind of goes with the species that every once in a while?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, I don't know. I mean, I've never really, other than this animal I just, did what I had to do to fix it. I don't make it a practice to usually go around feeling it to see how stiff or soft it is. So I really don't know. This particular animal, it almost felt like urate. It was so hard when it came out. So again, I don't know if that was a function of just maybe not having drinking enough water, or who knows.
Do you think that I noticed the more and more chondro people I talk to, the more and more say that they're going to mice? Is that something that's relatively new? Because do you think that has something to do with it? Have you feeding rats before?
I switched from mice to rats. Along, like this animal has probably never eaten a rat before. I don't think that's what it is, but
would you be kind of cautious with? I know you said it was a female, right?
Yeah.
I mean, would you be cautious with breeding her at all? You think maybe she would like accidentally prolapse with eggs?
It's possible. She produced a clutch for me last year, and I had plans to breed her again this year. And I'm just going to play it by ear. I'm definitely not going to pair her up now. I'm going to feed her and let her get a couple of defecations through her, and then kind of see, sort of analyze it at that point, see how she's done. And if she starts, goes back to business as usual, then I may try to pair her this year. So I don't know. I really think that was just kind of a freak thing. Like I said, it's never really happened to me in an adult until that. So I don't think it's anything with. Don't think it was caused by anything necessarily with my husbandry or anything like that. Otherwise, I would have thought at this point I would have seen it. More than would have seen it before now.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It definitely makes sense. Do you think the hydration, humidity, all that might be able to ease some of that stuff through if you get maybe a hard fecal?
Yeah, certainly could be. If an animal's not drinking as much, or certainly if they have, animal in a less humid cage is going to dry out sooner than one that's in a wet cage. I don't know. Prolapses are just one of those things that kind of been the Achilles heel of a lot of chondro breeders, and I don't know that anybody has really figured out exactly why they're so prone to it, or what causes it, or... one of those things that you just, just part of it, especially with babies. And in my experience, it's been mostly babies that it happens to. And I don't know why that's the case, why it happens more in babies than adults. But when it happens, you just try to deal with it and to catch it soon enough. Even bad prolapses in babies, I would say I've probably got a 50% success rate in having the animal go back to normal and being fine. 50% of them, the first time they, an animal that prolapses once, I would say probably half of them are you're going to save, and the other half it'll just be a recurring problem where it'll just, you may fix it and it may be fine for a couple months, but it'll just happen again. And then you fix it, and then it'll happen again, and then the thing just dies on. It's not often that that happens, and it doesn't happen to a lot of animals, but seems like once it prolapses once, a lot of times it's more prone to prolapse again.
Right. Now, when I worked for a zoo as head of reptiles, we had about three emerald tree boas, and we were told once by a fellow reptile guy, I guess, that we should do preventative measures for them to getting backed up and prolapse would be to inject their food with olive oil and let them eat it, and that would kind of lube them up. Any thoughts on that one?
Never heard of that one before.
We didn't do it because it sounded really weird to us, but I don't know. It's just something that kind of pops in my head every once in a while. I was like, well, I don't know. Maybe we should get a needle and inject this rat with olive oil. Wait, why would I do that? I don't know. So.
Yeah, I've never heard that one. I have heard injecting the prey item with water.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, that can't hurt. But olive oil, I can't say I've heard that one.
Okay. So.
Generally, when I first kind of was getting back into snakes, some people that I really looked up to were the Barkers, just because of the success they've had just across the board. And when I was doing a bunch of research before I got my first one, they always said on all the literature that I could find was that they had pretty good success with chondros, and their advice was treat them like any other python. And that's pretty much what I have, what I've done. I think, I think a lot of the problems that people experience with dream tree pythons are problems that they create by approaching the husbandry as if the snake is different than something else. If you approach it thinking that, oh, they got to be wet and they got to be, they got to be this and that, then
you're going to mess it up.
Yeah, it affects the way you keep the animal. Whereas if you just say, okay, it's a python, I'm going to follow general python husbandry, other than I'm going to give them a perch and, maybe I'm going to not feed them as much. That, in my opinion, is the way to go.
Okay. Good to know.
Okay. I got disconnected there for a second, but I'm back in the game.
For the love of God,
yeah.
We're so professional here.
Yeah. But let's switch gears. Let's talk about some breeding. So what's your approach to breeding chondros? Like, how do you approach that? Same as regular pythons, or do you do anything special?
Yeah, not really. Everything, the chondros, emeralds, the balls, the bloods, they're all in the same room. They're all pretty much subjected, the ambient room temperature is the same for all of them, obviously. I do use maybe slightly different temperatures on the thermostats for the racks and the cages and stuff. Really the only difference is the bloods. Don't like to get them too cool, just because I don't have a whole lot of experience with them. Like I said, I got a pretty small group, but from what I read, if you get them too cool, they tend to get respiratory infections. So I have the heat on their rack, but they don't get really below high 70s. But for the most part, just cycle them in the winter, temperature cycle them, like you know, people pretty much do for, or like most people do for any kind of Python. And I don't get them too cool. Low 70s is about as low as I'll like to get them. I'll cycle them for, I'll kind of do those, that temperature regimen for about a month, and then I start pairing them up. And usually you can tell, I would say 75% of the time, if a pair is going to be compatible or if they're ready, they'll breed the first night. Occasionally you'll have some that, you mean, maybe you leave them together and after a week you'll see them locked up. But for the most part, from what I've experienced, if they're going to breed, they're going to breed right away. I'll pair the male, I'll leave them together. As long as they're copulating, I'll leave them together as long as they want to do that. And then if I see the male, you know, kind of slack off for a day or two, or they're, you know, you don't see them locked up for a couple of days, I'll pull the male, take that opportunity to try to feed both of them while they're separated. I still feed females on the same schedule all year round, every other week. Males in the wintertime when they're breeding, I basically drop them down and feed them like once a month. I don't like to feed them a lot. I found that they tend to be more active and really better breeders if you feed them a little bit less. So, like I said, males, give them a good meal once a month, and that's about it in the wintertime. If they'll even eat at all, like a lot of other Morelia males just don't want to eat in the wintertime.
Right.
Really, a lot of pythons in general, males will not eat in the winter. But then I do, I will use, pretty much I always use one male on multiple females. A lot of people do one-to-one, and which is fine. But in my collection, the way it's set up, I'm very female heavy. I like for my males to be really, really super nice animals and just have a lot of in general, females maybe are not as nice. But I like to have a nice male because you can spread them around. And I've had really good luck doing that. Like last season, we brought up the Optimus Black Jr. and paired him with three females, and they all took. This year, I think I'm going to pair him with at least three and maybe even try four and see how he does.
Oh, wow.
Wow. And I've had pretty good luck with that. You know, Rosati's another animal that I've bred him pretty much every year with multiple females, and he's always come through for me. He's something I didn't mention earlier. He was from he's produced by Trooper Walsh, and he is was produced from a pairing of a Bushmaster produced Maruki bred to one of Trooper's kind of designer mutts, we like to call them, that was just kind of one of his animals from back in the day. And Versace was from that pairing. Well, it turns out that the Versace's dad, the Maruki, is sibs to the animals that Damon Southey's used that produced the first albino green tree python. So after that happened, Trooper realized that his male was a possible het, and because it was siblings to the two that produced the albino, and he bred that male back to the daughters, and he ended up producing an albino. So Versace's dad is a het albino, which makes Versace a 50% het. So it took me, I don't know, maybe 5 minutes to figure that out as soon as the first albino was hatched. And
wow.
Ever since then, this has been a project 10 years in the making now. I got my first babies from Versace in 2005, held back pretty much the entire clutch, and after I sexed them, kept all the females, ended up with four real nice females, and I've, over the last couple of years, have been breeding him back to the daughters to try to see if he's got the albino gene, and I've bred him back to two of the four, and no albinos yet. So, kind of thinking that maybe it's not going to happen now, but, you know, you never know. I got two more shots at it. So, this year I'll be breeding him with the two daughters that he hasn't produced with yet.
Oh, wow. Now, as far as the, well, let's talk about that real quick. The albino project, is that, how long has that been going on? It's, to me, I don't know. That seems like a long time. I guess it's a recessive gene, and chondros take a little longer. And
right. Recessive gene takes longer to raise them up. And I don't really like breeding females until they're a minimum of 4 years old. Sometimes they'll go 5 years before they're, at least the way I feed them, which is, you know, kind of sparingly, like I mentioned earlier. Sometimes it takes 4 or 5 years to grow a female up. And so Dayton hatched the very first one in 2000, and I believe it was 2002. And Trooper hatched his, and maybe it was like a couple years later, 2005 or something like that.
Right.
And since then, Damon's pretty tight-lipped about his stuff. He hasn't really updated his website lately, and he doesn't really talk about it a lot. So I'm not real sure what's gone on with him. How he may be sitting on 100 of them for all I know. But Rico has Trooper's albino now, and he's tried to breed it with different siblings and half-sibs, and he's just not a very good breeder. He's not produced anything as of yet, or maybe he may have produced one clutch. I can't remember if Midas is Trooper's albino. He's just been a really crappy breeder as of yet. And so no one, you know, unless Damon's got some stuff that he's just not talking about, no one's really had any luck breeding him, producing any. There was somebody last year actually produced two albinos, I believe it was a red and a yellow, from completely unrelated bloodlines to the known albino bloodline. Just kind of randomly hatched two albinos. Unfortunately, neither of them made it. They hatched out and then they died a couple days later, I think. But and that actually was from the blue bloodlines that a lot of people work with. So the albino gene now is potentially floating around in these blue animals that people have been working with for so long. And
wow.
Somebody just tossed one out randomly. So now, of course, everybody who's got blue line stuff is, you know, looking back on the pedigrees and trying to figure out where the gene may have entered, you know, the gene pool and what animals they have that they can cross to try to get one themselves. So
I guess that must be a pretty exciting day when you just randomly hatch out albino chondro.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
I can't even imagine, yeah. I mean, hell, wow. I've been trying at it for 10 years, and I'm going to be, there'll be a few beers drank that night, for sure, if I ever hatch one. But, you know. So, anyway, the full potential of the albino has not really been realized yet. If you see the albinos now, you're looking at just looks almost like a Kokiao or a canary chondro. Basically a yellow snake. There's really not anything super cool or crazy about them. But I think that if people are successful in producing them, you're going to really see it's going to really stand out when it's crossed with some of these other designer morphs.
You had the black chondro or the...
Yeah, it'd be white, yeah. He'd be white, probably. 80% white with some yellow specks, which would be pretty freaking cool.
yeah.
So, you know, I think hopefully in the next, you know, couple of years, people will have some success with Ethereum and maybe produce a few, and then hopefully down the line there'll be better breeders, and, you know, we'll see what happens. But,
okay.
Yeah, it's kind of been a disappointing project overall. There's a lot of excitement about it to begin with, but I think just the lack of success has kind of, you know, the hype's kind of died down a little bit.
Now, when I keeping chondros to me seems pretty straightforward, at least for the two that I have, and I don't really see what the big deal that everybody makes about it. But what I've heard is once they start breeding, they just randomly drop dead. Is that something that you've experienced? Or
holy crap. I don't want it anymore.
No, I've not experienced that personally. I have had some complications with breeding, you know, as far as maybe an egg-bound female or something like that. But as far as the only thing that I can really think of is, you know, when most people start to breed them, they lower the temperatures. And
right.
If you're lowering your temperatures down, you know, if you read some of these books like The Complete Chondro, which is a great book, it's got good information in it, but it's got a lot of information that, in my opinion, is sort of questionable. At least it would be for me and my setup. You know, it seemed to work for Greg Maxwell when he was doing it. But in the book, it tells you to cool your chondros down into the 60s, and that's just, to me, that's too cool. You don't need to get them that cool. So I could see somebody maybe doing that and, you know, not letting them get warm enough during the day, and that average body temperature comes down, and then they get a respiratory infection, and then, you know, it's kind of all downhill from there, especially if you don't catch it in time. Respiratory infection, I don't have a lot of experience with them, but from what I have dealt with, the sooner you get on them and start, you know, trying to fix it, the better luck you're going to have. It festers, and it just gets, if it gets bad, the longer a snake has it, the lower your chances are of fixing the problem. So if that happens, that would be my guess as to why, is that when you're breeding them, you're cooling them down, and they're just more prone to get sick when they're cool as opposed to hot. You know, when an animal has a respiratory infection, what's the first thing you do? You crank the heat up.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're cycling them and you've got them cool, it just seems like they're more prone to get sick. And I could see that maybe being a cause, but again, it's not something that I personally have noticed.
Okay.
So.
All right. Now, with the males, I was going to ask this back when you were talking about your males not eating and such. Do they do the when they're ready to breed? Are they cruising around their tub? Is that a sign you're looking for, or that they're ready to go? Okay.
Oh yeah, yeah. They cruise. They go off feed. They start cruising. A lot of them will not spray urate, but they'll just kind of leave urate all over the cage. That's another sign. And you know, they don't all do it. Some of them do, some of them don't. I've had animals that are great breeders that eat all year. They don't exhibit any of the typical signs. You know, they eat all year long, and they don't necessarily cruise the cage a lot. But you put them in with a female, and they're all over. So there seems to be maybe a lot of more, I don't know if you want to call it, individual personalities or whatever, but chondros, each individual seems to be, there seems to be more individual differences maybe than with other species for whatever reason.
Okay. Okay, cool. So One of the other things that I've heard a lot is that Biox, seems that a lot of people breed the designers into the Bioxes, and they get pretty nice results. Are they consistent? And, you know, like, what are the some of the characteristics that you'll see with doing that?
Yes. Yes and no. Yes, it is. You can get some pretty cool results, and a lot of people do it, and I've done it and gotten pretty good results out of it. It's not always consistent. You know, sometimes you just get a bust and you'll get all green animals. But for the most part, if you look, if you took kind of a sampling of all the different localities, for the most part, they seem to be pretty narrow in phenotype. In other words, like, you know, an Aru is pretty much going to be a nice, bright green animal with blue belly scales and white specks on it. They don't really vary a whole lot from that. Obviously, your Kopiales are going to be solid yellow. And Biox tend to have a lot more variation in them. There's some high yellows. There's some that have a lot of black in them. Occasionally, you'll see them with some blue. So there just seems to be a little bit more, again, a little more variability in them. And I don't know if it's maybe because if you look at a map, you know, Biox is a pretty isolated island. And I don't know if that's got something to do with it when you're taking those genes that have kind of been isolated and breeding them with a designer that's got, you know, every other locality mixed in with it, that maybe that could be one of the factors there. But yeah, you can get some pretty cool results. A lot of high blacks come from those kind of pairings, a lot of high yellows, and a lot of, you know, my favorite kind of look or morph is just anything with contrast, be it green and yellow or black or, you know, whatever. I like animals to have a lot of contrast in the pattern and in the color. And the Biox Houndstoppers tend to have a lot of that. For whatever reason. I mean, a lot of it has to do with the fact that if you just take a Biox and look at it, it's pretty contrasty animal to begin with. At least, you know, a lot of them are. And then, you know, you're breeding that into a designer line that's also, you know, high contrast and crazy colors, and it just seems to be a good mix most of the time.
Okay, good to know. Now, as far as the eggs, when you're getting eggs from these guys, do you do anything special for them, or are you looking at standard Python egg incubation?
Yeah, pretty much. I have one incubator, and it's a pretty good-sized one, but it, I do everything in there, the chondros, blood, balls. It's got a little bit, you know, I would say maybe you do them a little cooler than you would, say, a ball python or a blood, or a carpet even. 87.5 is kind of what I like to shoot for, would be, you know, ideal. If I had one incubator that I kept strictly for chondros, I'd probably set it at 87.5 or, you know, 88. So what I do is I just set my incubator for 88, and the upper shelves on mine, just because of the way it's set up, can be a degree to a degree and a half under that, and the lower shelves where my heat comes out tend to be a degree or degree and a half over. So I will incubate the chondros at the top and incubate the other stuff at the bottom.
Okay.
I do them sort of it's basically the no substrate method, where the eggs are not in contact with any substrate. They are suspended above, most people don't use any. They just put, you know, a quarter inch or a half inch of water in the bottom of an egg box, with some little stands or whatever and a piece of that plastic egg crating to hold the eggs up. What I do is I'll take vermiculite or perlite and completely saturate it with water. And just because I like doing it that way as opposed to just having water in the bottom, because I like to mess with my eggs a lot. You know, I'll take the box out and open it up and kind of let them get fresh air every couple, you know, weeks or two, or take them out and handle them, candle them. I just, you know, I tend to mess with them. So I like having a substrate in there because it keeps the water from sloshing around when you're moving the box. But the eggs aren't in contact with it.
Okay.
So I'll do that and incubate them at, you know, it's probably 87.5 to 88. And they hatch. I usually see hatches in about 51 days. But I do them all the same. All the pythons are incubated in the exact same way.
Okay. Now, I think the thing with the chondros is getting the babies going. Do you have any tips or tricks for that?
Yeah, that is the... No, if there's anything about them that's difficult, that's the hardest part, without a doubt. It's the most time-consuming. It's fairly easy to get them to breed, fairly easy to get the eggs and hatch the eggs, but getting the babies going can be a real, real pain in the ass, depending on, you know, sometimes some clutches, that tends to vary by clutch for whatever reason. Sometimes you'll get a clutch that, you know, all of them eat on the first time. And then you'll get a clutch where none of them eat on the first time. And it's just a real struggle getting them to eat. And you're spending, you know, 15, 20 minutes on every baby just teasing it. And, you know, they'll grab it and then they'll drop it. And then they'll grab it and they'll wrap it up. And they'll kind of get the you know, head of the pinky in their mouth, and then you, like, scratch your nose, and they freak out and drop it, and you're like, shit, you got to start all over again. So, I mean, one trick that I've kind of, the only trick that's really ever worked for me is chick scent. I keep, like, some baby chicks in the freezer, and I will, you know, pull some of the down feathers off of them and just kind of keep it in like a plastic bag, and I'll, you know, stick the pinky's nose in it and like throw the pinky's out in the water so they're kind of wet and, you know, the feathers will stick to them, and then grab the pinky by the hindquarters with the tongs, stick their nose in the feathers and get that stuff to their head, and then put them under like a little halogen death lamp. Put them like right under it where they get real hot and heat the feathers up, and I would assume that it makes the feathers kind of gives them a smell, you know, makes them smell a little bit more. And it's to the point where I don't even try feeding babies without chick scent anymore, because I've just, if a baby is going to, you know, there may be an animal that would eat without it that maybe you've got to spend 10, 15 minutes on it, you know, trying to tease it and get it aggravated enough to strike, whereas if you use the chick scent, it'll eat like in a second. So automatically, I try chick scent on every baby the first time. And that has worked for me. I probably get about 75 to 80% of them to eat right off the bat. And the other 25%, you know, some of them are never going to eat. And I'll assist feed them a couple of times to try to give them, or like maybe give them pinky heads. And sometimes that's all it takes. A couple, you know, certain percentage of them, a couple of assist feeds, and then they kind of get the hang of it, and then they're good to go. And within, you know, a couple of months, they're just the same size as the other one, and they're eating just as aggressively, and they're just as good. Others, it's just... It's just a struggle constantly, and they never eat, they never do well. Back when I first started doing it, I would kind of nurse these babies along and would assist feed them basically until they died. But nowadays, I'll assist feed them a couple of times, and if they don't take at that point, then they just kind of eat or die kind of deal. I definitely don't nurse them along anymore other than those first couple of assist feeds. And there's a lot of debate on whether you want those animals in the gene pool reproducing. Because a lot of people believe, and, you know, there's pretty good data that backs up that good feeders tend to produce offspring that are also good feeders. So, you know,
right.
In theory, you don't want animals, you really don't want to nurse poor feeders too much because you don't want those genes in the gene pool. So, again, there's some debate about that, and some people feel strongly one way or the other that, you know, some people feel like you have a duty to, you know, give every baby assist feed it until, you know, it's just until it dies, and you've got your responsibility to get it going. And, you know, I'm kind of somewhere in the middle. I'll give them an assist feed or two, but after that, that's pretty much it.
Right. Yeah, I guess I don't know where I would sit on that. I mean, I had a couple carpets that held out. I just kind of held it, waited out. I didn't assist feed, but I definitely used that trick before, a trick down with carpets, and it worked. So, yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, that's a good one. A lot of people will dip. Yeah, I've heard that dipping the pinky in chicken soup will sometimes elicit a feeding response. I've heard of, you know, rubbing them on raw chicken. You know, there's all kind of tricks. The only thing that's really ever worked for me personally is the chick down.
Right.
And there's some technique in it, too. You kind of have to, you know, you don't want to, they're pretty flighty when they're babies, and they can spook them easily. And kind of think of it from their perspective. They're this thing that's freaked out that everything's going to eat them, and here this big giant thing is pulling their tub open and, you know, shoving a pinky mouse, which they in the wild would never eat, and, you know, shoving it in their face and smacking them around with it, and it's, you can see how they would be scared of that and how it wouldn't be successful. So you kind of got a, there's a certain way to do it where you kind of agitate them without spooking them. That's kind of the trick, you know. You want to do it from the underside and just make it to where it's not, where they kind of get aggravated and they don't get in a defensive, they don't get on the defensive.
Right.
I'm pissed off, but not scared.
Yeah, I think one of the things, I had two baby sarong green trees that I couldn't get going. For the life of me, they just wouldn't eat. But what I couldn't get over is how small they were. They're tiny.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think people don't realize that, haven't dealt with chondros, how tiny they are. Yeah, so.
Yeah, baby chondros are very small. I mean, you've got to feed them. Some of them are bigger than others, but in general, they're pretty small. You've got to feed them just like day-old pinkies for the first 5 or 6 meals. Then, you know, they get a little bit of size on them, and you can bump them up to a larger pink. But right out of the egg, they're very small. You know, 9 to maybe 12 grams or something like that.
Wow, it is tiny. So,
okay.
How about, can you give us a little bit of a history of the carpet coalition? I'm sorry, chondro coalition.
Good job, Owen.
Shut it.
Yeah,
the chondro coalition.
The chondro coalition was basically the brainchild of Trooper Walsh. Essentially what it is, there's a group of maybe 7 or 8 of us that are all really passionate about green tree pythons. And I think the idea behind it was kind of everybody sort of banding together to give people one place where they could go to it, like a show, and see all the different morphs and, you know, bloodlines, have kind of it all consolidated in one place, and kind of give people a better buying experience, if you will, just as far as having a bigger selection. And, you know, everyone's very knowledgeable, not that there's not, you know, bickering like there is bickering and arguing about pretty much everything, husbandry, bloodline. Everyone's got their own opinion and their way they do things. But for the most part, everybody gets along very well, and that was kind of the idea behind it. Started in, I think maybe the first show that they did together was 2002 or 2003, something like that. And every year, we used to do the Daytona show as well as Tinley. And Daytona's just kind of gotten a little lame over the last couple of years, especially for Condros. I think the last time we did that show was maybe, I don't know, it's been a couple of years, 2010 or something like that, and it was just pretty bad as far as just there wasn't a whole lot of interest in Condros. So we elected, haven't done it since then, and I've been doing Tinley. And I just went to Tinley for the first time this year, and it was great. So, anyway, that's kind of the background on the coalition. There's, again, seven or eight people that are in it, and just whoever can, you know, come to a particular show, you come, and we split the table. And back 4 or 5 years ago, we all went in and, you know, bought the displays together and banners and lights and kind of all the, you know, all the junk you need to do a show. And whoever comes, and it works out well because, you know, sometimes you've got a lot of animals and maybe somebody else doesn't, or sometimes you just need, you know, to display a couple of things and you're not sitting there at a table, you know, a huge table with three animals on it, you know, so it's kind of good in that regard.
Gotcha. So, what do you think, kind of looking like the future for the condo market? Do you think it's looking pretty good? Are you going to see more people getting into the condos, or do you think it's kind of going to be dipping down a little bit?
I think interest will always be high, just because they're such a cool looking snake, and if they didn't have the bad reputation, I think there'd be a lot more interest in them. But as far as the market goes, what I have seen is that the market for the most extreme animals is going up. And the market for your average kind of run-of-the-mill is going down. And I think that's mainly because, you know, you're dealing with importers and farm animals. And so, you know, it's hard to convince somebody that doesn't really know what they're looking at that they should buy your captive bred Aru for whatever, $400 or $500, when this guy over here at his table's got 50 of them and they're, you know, $150 or $200 a piece. So the average stuff is getting less expensive, but kind of the top shelf stuff, if you want to call it that, or, you know, the most extreme pairings or the most extreme animals, the market for them is small, but they seem to be going up in value. People are paying more for them than they were when I got into it, and that's been, you know, whatever, 15 years ago. So most snakes, other species in general, kind of go the opposite way. You know, like you look at a morph or something like that, that is a simple recessive or dominant trait. They start off expensive, and every year that goes by, they come down and come down and come down until they're pretty much the same price as the normal. And And that's one thing about the way chondrogenetics works, is that it's kind of kept that higher end market high, and kept the value. You know, those animals have kept their value, and again, have seemed to be increasing in value. So it's also kind of a strange market too, because it's you know, I can see how it'd be intimidating for somebody who's just getting into it when, you know, you're buying this animal, and if you wanted to buy like a super nice designer, you're going to pay a couple thousand dollars for it, and it you can't sex it, you don't know what it's going to look like. You're kind of taking a gamble that there's no guarantee that that $5,000 baby is not going to turn into a green male at a year old and be worth, you know, $1,000.
Right.
You might get lucky, and it might increase in value tenfold after it changes color. But, you know, there are a certain percentage of them that turn green. So I think that part of it is kind of maybe hurt the market a little bit, in that people are reluctant to maybe jump in because of that. Now, the way to fix that is you just buy color-changed animals, but of course, you know, to do that, you're gonna lay out a lot more cash to get started than you would buying babies.
Right. Okay. So I guess we just gotta wipe away the stigma of them, and we'll everyone will have a chondro. What's your most exciting pairing for the upcoming season for 2013?
I would say pretty much anything that's got Optimus Black Jr. in it is going to be super nice. We've got a couple of nice females here that are also kind of calico line stuff that I think he's going to go, you know, is going to be a real good match for him. And then I've also got some animals here that are on loan that are super crazy high yellow.
Wow.
Bright neon screaming yellow. Probably, you know, 80 to 90% bright yellow with a couple of green scales here and there. I think that's going to be a really cool pairing. And you know, probably the coolest one is going to be the one that I'm not even thinking of, that, you know, you breed them and you're not really expecting anything great out of them, and you get that sleeper selection. Then where, you know, for whatever reason, the compatibility of those two particular animals, you get, you know, really good results from it. So.
Cool. Definitely very cool, and it does kind of add a little bit of a mystery to it that anything can be the pair that was really cool or not. So now we get to the good questions. These are the ones that we're going to make you think.
All right.
So now, if you could have any chondro in your collection, what would it be? And money is no object.
Wow. Kind of a tough question, just because there's so many that I would want. I would probably say that would be this animal that John Holland owns. It's Mr. Blue, and it's probably
I think he was the last time we had a chondro person on. They said the same thing.
Oh, really?
I think everybody wants Mr. Blue.
Yeah, Mr. Blue, he's an older animal. I think he was 96 or something like that, 96 hatch. And he has been responsible for producing, you know, most of the blue, super blue animals that you see today. And that's one thing that my collection is lacking. Is blue. I don't work with a whole lot of blue stuff. For whatever reason, I've always liked the high yellow stuff better. And and so I don't have a lot of it, and he would look great in this room. So that's what I would
He'd look very pretty right over there.
Yeah.
That's right.
All right. So if you could have any other Morelia, what would it be?
Again, so many choices. I really like the Ruffies just because they're
yes.
little unusual. You know, they're not really much to look at, in my opinion, as far as, you know, you bring 100 people into the room and you show them a green tree python and then show them a rust tail. People who don't know anything about snakes, you know, probably 99% of them are going to say the chondro is a cooler looking snake. Just because they're unusual, I like them. I don't know, you know, bolens obviously are would be up there. Thought about getting them, but they're just the size and it's just kind of kept me away. But I think my favorite non-chondro Morelia is probably the Moluccan scrub python.
I love mine.
Really like those. Really like the head on them, you know, the big head scales and the color. And so I would probably say those.
Cool.
Awesome. So now if you could pick any non-Morelia, what would it be?
I think the next thing that I'm kind of looking to get into is I'm really, does it have to be snake or can it be anything? Non-Morelia, so I guess I'm assuming that means it could be anything. I want to get some dwarf monitors. Some Ashies or some Kimberly Rocks maybe or some of the, I think they're called Crisis.
Yes.
I've kind of been looking at all three of those and I've never really been into lizards just because of the bugs, you know, having to deal with
right.
Crickets is just like one more thing that I don't need in my life right now. But I've kind of been getting the bug for them lately. So I've been doing a lot of reading and looking at maybe trying to get a cage set up. And I think that'll be the next new species that I bring into the collection will probably be some kind of dwarf monitor.
Ackies are fantastic monitors. I'm just going to say that. My friend breeds the yellows and the reds.
Uh-huh.
And they produce, once they start rolling, they'll breed about 6 months out of the year. And they'll just produce like a couple eggs every month. So they're always firing out babies. And he only has to feed, he just lets the crickets kind of free range in their giant enclosures for these animals because he keeps them in breeding colonies.
Uh-huh.
So he'll let the crickets free range. And then you also throw the dubia in there. And that's that, I mean, he maybe throws them some pinkies every once in a while. But other than that, they're pretty much set in a little ecosystem. It's great. So.
Yeah, I'm afraid that I think my wife would probably draw the line at me keeping a roach colony in the house. So I don't know if you don't know,
come on.
Snakes, yes. Roaches, no.
Yeah, my wife's pretty cool and understanding, and she puts up with a lot of shit with the, you know, with the reptiles like everybody flocks those. She's really into them, but. I think the roaches would be the that may be what gets me divorced. So I would like to stay away from those.
You got to convince her to get a bearded dragon, and then it's her fault the roaches are here, and then you're just using them too. So
right.
Yeah.
Okay. So before we're almost out of time, but I want to get your info out there. So how can we go and get a snake from you? I think your site is on Facebook, right?
Yeah, my site's on Facebook. You don't have to be, you don't have to have a Facebook account to view it. And it's got my email address on it, but it's Chondrolicious Reptiles, and that's Chondrolicious Reptiles. And if you just go to Facebook.com and type that into the search, it'll pull you right up. And that's pretty much what I use for updates and photos. And, you know, I try to post things every couple of days. I'll post a photo of something, especially in the hatching and breeding season, just kind of let people know what's going on as far as pairings and whatnot. But yeah, that'd be the best way.
Okay, cool. Yeah, you know, thanks for coming on and talking chondros with us, and, you know, appreciate it. And you got a great collection, and, you know, wish you best of luck this upcoming season.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. I was glad to be here. It's been a pleasure talking to you guys.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
All right, guys. Talk to you later.
Have a good night.
Have a good night. Well, there we go. Another Chondro episode under the belt. You know, we have to have more Chondro talk on Morelia Python Radio. Not enough love for Chondro, as far as I'm concerned.
I think we have plenty of love for the Chondro.
You know, I've been holding out because...
Well,
no, I mean, they're such a cool little python. I mean, you know, they don't get too big. They have awesome color to them. I think they're just like, you know, they're really cool.
Picture. Yeah, there's a picture that comes up when you call me, and it's one that was taken of you at Carpet Fest, staring at that Biak that we were auctioning off. You got this look on your face of like, I want this. I don't want anybody else to take this. I want this. It's like that sums up your total what you think about chondros, and that one look on your face of ooh, pretty.
Yeah.
So yeah. I understand.
I mean,
what
come
you're
on,
saying.
You can't tell me you didn't walk into the Carpet Fest when you saw the snake sitting on the table, and you can't
she
tell me that chondro
gorgeous.
didn't pull you in.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
She was gorgeous, and thank God you bid and quickly got that taken care of, because
yes.
God damn, she was pretty.
Yeah.
And actually, my tanner bars were at Carpet Fest.
Yep.
Yes.
I almost bought them, too.
Yeah, well, I had them.
Yeah, they were
great
nice.
Great victory for me. They're gorgeous. Mean. So Chris is going to deal with them.
Yeah.
But, which he says the 15th. So.
Okay. Very good.
Yeah, we have that. We locked away. All right, cool. Anyway, but that's very cool. If you want to do more chondros, I'll let you do more chondros.
Yeah, I just sometimes I hold off because I know that's not your 100% thing, and you know,
it's fine.
Sometimes it's hard to have, you know.
You're trying to get me killed by the chondro people? Shut the hell up! It's my, I love them. They're great.
Yeah.
it's fun to learn about that stuff. I'm always wanting to figure out new species, and eventually something might happen where they end up at my place, and I'd like to know something. Goddamn it.
I don't want you to buy a chondro until I breed chondros and you buy them from me.
Okay. Well, no. Here's the thing. The problem is that with our two places and our two projects, okay. You know what? And all of our projects, okay, I won't get chondros unless they get from you. You best not get any liasses unless it's coming from me. And if ever you do plunge into the Leo Python.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Well, of course. Yeah. We'll trade.
Barnett. Barnex, you have a pair of Barnex, right? Not enough. We'll get your Barnex. We'll get you everything.
Well, you know me. I just like to focus on Morelia. That's my thing. That's my niche.
Do you have a list of the Morelia you still need to cross out that entire species?
Yeah, pretty much. Ruffies, Bolins, and Owen Pellies. That's it.
If you get Ruffies before me, I will kill you. You can take them. I'm just throwing that out there. You focus on the Bolins. Get your Bolins.
I definitely would get Bolins before I would get Ruffies.
Good.
Yeah. Ruffies are cool. I like them, and I think they're neat, but they don't do the same thing for me as...
That Bolin
and don't get me
do.
Wrong. Like, all Morelia is it for me. But, like, Bolins pythons, to me, is the pinnacle...
I think you're pretty obsessed with your Bolins when they get here or when you do get them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I come on, man. That's a solid black and yellow snake with... come on, that's just... that. Oh, man, it's just nuts.
you know what else is a black and yellow snake?
A jungle.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, but it's not the same. It doesn't have that, like... To me, like, a Bolins python has that, like, their heads almost look like a skull, you know what I mean?
They,
it's got,
they
like that.
Are, and they have, like, bricks for heads. I mean, they got big, big heads. They remind me of my Barnex, but it's like, and I think also they have that evil to breed, and you're like, aha, so you think, and, you know, then when you don't breed it, you're like, apparently it is, so.
Yeah, so, I mean, I got plenty of projects as far as trying to breed Morelias, you know, all the different scrubs I got and all that kind of stuff, so I'm going to be busy.
You have Lincoln?
Yeah, of course, I have a pair.
Oh, well, okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure you have every single scrub thing we have, so.
Yeah, I don't really have.
Yeah.
I'm going to get more into the localities of the Barnecks, but until I have more room, I'll probably hold off on that.
Dear Lord, you should.
Yeah.
The Barnecks are massive.
I definitely. I probably will get another female, and that will probably be the extent of my. Barnack, but I think I like some of the localities though, like the Jayapuras and the Waminas and I forget what the other one is that
it's
I really like. What's that?
It begins with a K, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't pronounce it. I see the word in my brain, but I can't pronounce it.
Whatever.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
That one. So,
they kind of remind me of King Horneye.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people don't like the Marooks. I don't know why. I think, honestly, from talking to Nick before, Marooks are a southern locality. And I think that the northern locality, I hope I'm right on this, but the northern locality of Barnecks are easy to breed. It's the southern localities that are hard to breed.
Okay.
And the Marooks.
I have Northerns.
Yeah, you have Northerns, I believe.
Good.
But the Southerns are a little more difficult. I think if I was going to... I think my favorite locality, though, is the Beox that
yes.
Dave has.
They were fantastic looking.
Yeah.
And
so.
Massive. And he's like, oh, yeah, I got bit by one of those. I'm like, and you're still alive? It's like,
yeah.
And I'm like... And, of course, like, I'm down there, and Tim, me, and Chris is like, yeah, it seems like, you know, I used to mess with cobras, and he's like, oh, yeah, I got tagged by this giant Beak, and I'm like, 6 foot carbon python is the max of where I go. What the hell is the matter with you two? But it's like, dear God, huge,
yeah.
But gorgeous animals.
Yeah, I like the scrubs, but I'm just like, I look at it from, you know, I remember talking to Nick about it, and I think at one point Nick had the largest collection of scrubs in the U.S.,
yeah.
And
yeah.
It was hard to justify having that much space and not getting any results, you know, because a lot of those species are hard to breed, you know. So...
Yeah.
But
that's why we have site B that has all the hard shit. I have carpet python. Even though apparently the Variant J is belong over at site freaking B.
they belong at EB Morelia. That's where they belong.
Shut up. You want it? You want fine. Take
them over here.
Breed them,
they'll
send
be
them
breeding
back.
Next week.
You take them, you breed them, you give me the babies. I'm okay with this.
Okay. If I do that, then you can never mention artificial. First and third. Ever again. That will be
oh,
it.
Oh, God, it's a terrible
that,
trade.
It will go into the vault and be locked away forever.
No, I wouldn't be able to live it down. I'd be like, how'd you meet Eric? Eric had to breed them. Oh.
Yeah, you could never live that one down. That's
no,
true.
It'd be terrible. And then I wouldn't be able to use the artificial... No. Incubation thing is a retort, so I just lose every time.
Yeah. Exactly.
No, sorry, this can't happen. Nope, we're going to do it ourselves. And good answers and yell at them some more.
Yeah. So, okay, so basically, Marcel, he ended up our guest for the year.
Yeah, we're done for 2012. We survived.
We have one more episode next week. And I thought it would be cool if we get the chat going over on Morelia Python Forum while we do the show, and it can be sort of like a round back show. We'll be talking about whatever. If you want to call in, you want to ask us questions, you know, whatever it will be. But That'll be the last show. Then we'll be off for 2 weeks, and then we're coming back with a bang. And I know there's a couple of shows that we have lined up. One, you said the 15th, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Chris is coming on, and White Lips.
White Lips and Parnax. It's Chris Foley from Rogue Reptiles.
There you go.
Yeah, the other half. Holy shit.
I'm going to this you have to send me an outline now.
I knew this was happening. I knew this was coming. Yeah. I knew it so much. Luckily, I have several weeks to prepare.
Yeah.
So it means that I won't be sending you an outline until like 5 minutes. It's just going to be like, yeah, asking questions.
Yeah. And then at the end of the month, I don't have the date in front of me right now, but Casper Christensen from Casper Singular Reptiles. I think I got that right. Yeah.
He's
calling us all the way from Denmark.
Holy shit.
So
that's another country off the...
Yeah. Cold world, Denmark. So he's going to be talking Moralia, and he owns King Horneye. So we're going to be talking some King Horneye talk with him.
Wow.
He has some pretty nice species of Moralia, so that should be pretty exciting. We have an olive python show lined up, and then a couple other guests that we will keep you in suspense until the next year.
Yes, because we don't know ourselves. sorry, I wasn't supposed to say that part. Never mind.
Yeah, so, that's between me and you, Owen. What the hell?
Too late. It's too late now. It's out there. Anyway.
things to check out. Go over to MoraliaPythons.com. That's the forum. And I know I read on a post somewhere that Facebook is sort of killing forums.
From what I can see with some of that stuff, a lot of people are just posting pictures and talking right on Facebook as opposed to joining up and doing the forums, which... You can understand, but I still think that you can do more on a forum than you can on Facebook. Plus, not everybody has Facebook.
That's true. And I think that the face, to me, at least to me, the Facebook is sort of an accent to the forum. I think the forum, I think what people might forget is that there's tons of backlogged scripts to where you can go back and you can look on different things. You can't really get that on Facebook.
No.
Silly, I guess. I don't know how long Facebook keeps their archives and stuff, but you're not going to be able to get the same type of thing. So I think forums, at least Moralia Pythons to me, will always be my mainstay. I don't go to a lot of the other ones that I used to as much, but that's a staple. I check that every day. So go over there, check it out, and definitely, you know, sign up. And next week, you know, I think you have to be signed up with a post in order to go over and chat. But come over and chat with us, and it would be a good time.
Yep.
But we have the poll of the week that's going on over there. And Chris Behoff, like I said at the beginning of the show, from CB Reptiles, he's the guy that pretty much puts that up every week. And the poll this week is, do you tell your neighbors about your snake? So go over there, put your thoughts, your comments, whatever you're thinking, and we'll talk about it next week and see what the next question is. What else? Check out MoraliaPythonRadio.com. That's going to take you to all of our different spots. You can download us on iTunes. That you'll be able to get it from there. You can listen to it right on the show page. It also takes you to our Facebook page, so make sure you go over and like that. And it will also take you to our group that we have over on our Facebook page. It's Moralia Pick of the Week. And that pretty much encompasses Moralia. You can post it up and brag about your awesome. Well, I think I want to say we're at 489 members.
Wow.
It's we're up there with members, so that's pretty cool. What else? What am I forgetting? Oh, shout out to don't forget Herp Nation, the article with Mark Spataro about the Bolins. Go check that out. And I think the Reptile Report is going to put this show up tomorrow. I talked to those guys the other day, and you know, that's definitely a go-to that I go to every day. They pretty much scour the entire World Wide Web, and they get the best reptile-related news and categorize it and point you right to the forums or wherever the website that the information is coming from. So that's pretty cool. Definitely go over and check that out. That's www.thereptilereport.com. And then the only other thing I have is just be watching, for me personally, watch E.B. Morelia. I'm going to be starting to, with the start of my breeding season, I'm going to be keeping a detailed diary. So you can go over there and check that out and see what I have going on. Other than
you
that.
You call it a diary. You call it a breeding log or journal.
Breeding log, journal, diary. What I call
That's
it.
That's too late now.
I'm feeling very, you know, close with the snakes. I want to be diary. You know, but I am undertaking, like I said before, a huge experiment, I guess you would say, or just a, yes. I'm basically logging the temperatures every day, everything, temperature outside, temperature of the room, temperature of the tub, cage, you know, what the animal is at, where they are at, observations that I'm making, where they shed, blah, blah, blah. What sky's the limit. Just anything that I can take down as far as data, and then at the end of the breeding season, hopefully I can sort through all that and that's all I got, Owen. What do you got?
What I got is definitely check out rogue-reptiles.com. We are almost completely, fully up to date. The only problem is we keep getting more animals, so we keep coming out of date quickly. But the website is up and running. Also, you can go and like Rogue Reptiles on Facebook. That will get you the latest news on all the things going with Rogue. Also, check out our ads on kingsnake.com. It will definitely be very cool with all that stuff. We don't have any shows coming up, but we might have some major news on the front of what we will be breeding this year. As far as the carpet pythons and other things like that over here, we're definitely starting our Barneck project and Gold Phase White Lips over at Chris's place. So definitely very cool. Keep track of all the stuff that we're going to be doing this year. Yeah, that's it. All right. So I guess if I got nothing, you got nothing, I guess we'll be done. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and tune in next week for some more Morelia Python Radio.
Okay.
Yep, we're done.
All right. Good night.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.